Welcome to The Beat, a podcast series from the cops office at the Department of Justice, featuring interviews with experts from a varied field of disciplines. The Beat provides law enforcement with the latest developments and trending topics in community policing. Today's interview is on location at the cops office-sponsored PERF-hosted forum on unmanned aircraft systems. Hello, I'm your host, Jennifer Donnellan. Michigan State Police's aviation unit works closely with all Michigan law enforcement agencies, as well as the Michigan National Guard and the United States Coast Guard air stations. Since February of 2015, this has also included an Unmanned Aircraft Systems Program, or UAS, commonly known as drones. Today, we are happy to have with us Sergeant Matt Rogers, one of the program's four drone operators. Also with us is Lieutenant Colonel Chris Kalinske, commander of the Michigan State Police's Specialized Services Bureau. Welcome, gentlemen, to The Beat. To start off, tell us briefly about the Michigan State Police's UAS program. Why did you begin using drones in 2015? What were you interested in achieving that you could not with troopers or helicopters? Colonel Kalinske?
Back in 2011, 2012, we saw this as an emerging technology. And at the time, I was overseeing the aviation unit. And we saw that this was a possibility to help us with some of our missions just because of the cost of using a helicopter for everything. This might be a way to offset some of those. And clearly, with it being an emerging technology, we saw some of the potential benefits. Some that kind of surprised us, because what we thought we were going to use it for really kind of flipped, and we haven't been using it for some of those missions. And I'll let Sergeant Rogers kind of explain a little bit more on the early stages, because I left and really handed it off to him, and he took control of it.
Yeah, so early on in our program, because of the FAA's regulations on you had to be a manned aircraft pilot, I was actually brought into the unit to kind of start this program off because of my previous experience as a manned aircraft pilot. Early on, there were a lot of challenges, especially for us as a state police agency, because we were asking for an entire state to operate in. The FAA had yet to grant an approval of an entire state for law enforcement's operation. So we had a lot of back and forth with the FAA. It took us over 7 months to actually get that approval from the FAA, and it included a two-day visit from the FAA where they, day one, sat through and looked at all of our documentation and policies and procedures and things like that, and then day two, we had to do actually demonstration flights for them, scenario-based flights to just show our level of competency. So looking back at 2014, 2015, this was the landscape that the UAS program was in. Not to mention, we certainly had a lot of challenges with the general public at that time, too.
Challenges with the general public. Okay, Colonel, can you expand on that? Any other challenges?
So early on in this program, before we even had our first UAS, and it's important to know that we refer to it as a UAS and not a drone. We haven't referred to it as a drone just because the negative connotation that carried with it, because drones were being used overseas at the time, so we wanted to make sure that we were using the terminology that was more appropriate for continental U.S. use. But the overarching concern was the privacy rights. So we made sure that we brought in the ACLU and had discussions with them and sat down to make sure that we were addressing any of their concerns that they may have, because that was going to start us off on the right foot, as well as to develop those relationships with those advocates who will bring to our attention some things that we may not have thought of. And then the other overarching piece we had concerns with was obviously safety. We needed to make sure that all the residents were safe, as well as, you know, any commercial vehicles or anyone flying manned aircraft was safe.
You've talked about the fact that you are the first state agency to work with the FAA on a statewide UAS program, and that what you thought would be the primary uses have turned out to be something else. Tell us more about that, Sergeant Rogers.
Sure. Well, initially, very early on, we thought that search and rescue would be a primary role for the UAS. Our UAS program is housed within our aviation unit, so we have five helicopters, two fixed-wing aircraft, and then we have five UAS systems currently as well. Very early on, we suspected that UAS would be used for that search and rescue piece. And what we actually found was once we started deploying the technology, we realized that the UAS is really limited by the field of view of the camera. So a manned helicopter over that same scene is able to clear that area much faster than what a UAS could. So if we're searching for a missing person, time is of the essence, obviously. We want to get that asset deployed on scene as quickly as possible. And, you know, if you just imagine an open field during the day or even at night, the UAS is limited by the field of view of the camera, where during the day a helicopter could fly over that same open field and clear it within a matter of minutes, where it would take a UAS at least a half hour or so to clear that same field. So thinking that search and rescue is going to be one of the first things we would use it for, that has kind of dropped to the bottom of the list. One thing that emerged as we started the program was fire scenes. So we have arson investigators within the state police, so they are called to any suspicious fire. And actually, our very first deployment for the UAS was for a fire scene. And that is our number one call for service today. So we've done a little over 650 missions with three unmanned aircraft to this point. And the number one call for service is for that fire scene. So the imagery that we're able to give the fire investigators is something that they've never been able to get before unless they had a fire engine with a ladder truck and a camera that they could climb up the ladder and take some photos with. So the detailed imagery we were able to provide them certainly aids in their investigation when it comes to determining these fires that they're investigating.
So you have three units for the entire state?
Correct. There's three units. We just received grant funding for two more, so we're just waiting to deploy those into the field.
Are they dispersed geographically within the state of Michigan, or are they located in a central location?
They're dispersed geographically around the state, yes. We have seven districts in the state, so you know the ultimate goal for the Michigan State Police is to put one of these systems in every single district initially, and then we'll maybe drill down to post-level UAS systems.
To continue with Sergeant Rogers, search and rescue is not a primary use of your UAS program. So how are they used? Tactical? Response? Surveillance?
Yeah, so search and rescue, we really don't use it much, the UAS for it. That's still a manned aircraft job mission, in our opinion. We do use it to assist our emergency support team on calls. We've used it successfully in locating a suspect who fled into a cornfield, located him within minutes with a FLIR camera. I mean, having that asset on station at that time certainly proved beneficial to clear that cornfield and locate the suspect. Surveillance, so that's a great, great question. We are fortunate in the state of Michigan to have a legislature that supports our endeavors, and they have not restricted law enforcement in any way with this technology. Partly because I think we have taken upon ourselves to regulate ourselves and really provide a common sense approach as to when we deploy this technology and when we don't. So the first thing that comes to mind is privacy rights. That's the first question we ask ourselves is are we within the Fourth Amendment here to put this UAS over the scene of somebody's house? Now, there's no case law that says we can. There's no case law that says we can't, right? However, in that instance, if any agency requests our services with the UAS and it is a surveillance-based mission, we will require a search warrant.
Colonel Kalinske, what would you like to add to that?
You know, we've also, you know, we have flooding in Michigan. Out of all the disasters or emergencies, flooding seems to be the biggest issue we deal with. And the Michigan State Police oversees emergency management, homeland security in Michigan, as well as our law enforcement duties. And what we recently have been doing is utilizing not only our rotary aircraft, but the UAS to help us with damage assessments. There's areas where areas would be flooded, streets would be flooded, and we might have to wait over a week sometimes to get into that area to do damage assessments or put boats in. We can take the UAS, fly it down a street, either real time or take images of those homes to get the information, and we can clear, you know, a whole block and do the damage assessments and get the information needed so we can start the community to recover. So for those agencies that have those responsibilities, it's a great tool to have when you're doing damage assessments during natural disasters, in addition to some of the fire scenes that we've dealt with.
So, Colonel, the program is Michigan State Police owned and operated, but beneficial throughout the state in broad and maybe yet to be identified ways?
Yes, like many of our specialty resources, we have a lot of jurisdictions and communities that may not have the funding to not only purchase the equipment, but you also have the maintenance, the training, the upkeep, the personnel. We utilize our GIS folks to assist, and there's many agencies that don't have that capability. So we bring a lot of tools to the table, and we're there to support our local partners in any way we can with those resources.
So if you're talking with another state or even municipal entity about starting a drone program, what are the things you would tell them are critically important to focus on, Colonel?
I think from where I sit as a lieutenant colonel, the privacy rights have to be up front. You have to be transparent with your communities. You have to make sure that you're doing everything possible to ensure real or perceived that those privacy rights are not being violated and that you have a safe program, because it's only going to take one incident to really, really hurt that trust, like a lot of different areas in public safety.
Sergeant Rogers, anything to add?
Yeah, and one thing to add to that, you know, as you start a program, you kind of have to look down the road at the end game. So if you're going to deploy a UAS over a scene, you need to ask yourself, am I going to be defensible in court if I need to submit this imagery, or am I going to be potentially creating bad case law for law enforcement across the country? There's case law back from 1989. Florida versus Riley was the actual case, and it was a deputy in Florida. He had a tip of somebody growing some marijuana plants in a backyard. Well, he goes to the scene. There's a 6-foot privacy fence. They had a helicopter, I believe the sheriff's department did. He gets in the helicopter. He testifies that he flies over the property, Riley's property, at 400 feet above the ground with the helicopter. They see the marijuana plants. They send in the cavalry. They seize the plants. Well, Mr. Riley contested the search. It goes all the way through the Florida Supreme Court. The Florida Supreme Court reverses and says it was a bad search, it was illegal. It goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court reverses that and says any manned aircraft can be at 400 feet above the ground legally and see the exact same thing the deputy saw. Therefore, it was a legal search. That's really the most recent case law we have on the books for law enforcement putting an aircraft over a property, and the case is based off 1989 when the U.S. Supreme Court certainly didn't imagine today's technology when they made that decision. So it's important for law enforcement, because we have that latitude right now with our manned aircraft units, that we're careful when we deploy a UAS, because the UAS per FAA rules and regulations has to be at 400 feet or below. So there's certainly a slight gray area there. I just think we're asking for trouble by putting that technology over a property without a search warrant.
So what I'm hearing is, think critically. First, about how you're going to use it. Then what is the most appropriate use depending on federal, state, and local guidelines, and then actually design a program that fits within that framework. Is that accurate?
Yep. Yes.
So, Colonel Kolinsky, what are the benefits of having your UAS team work with your agency's Geographic Information Systems, or GIS team?
So when we were first getting into this, one of the questions that we had is, who's going to process all the data from the scenes? A lot of people think of this as it's just video, or we're just taking a couple images. But the scenes that we shoot, you could have 40 images, you could have hundreds of images. And the GIS team in Michigan, they work in the state police, emergency management, homeland security division. They process that data once our pilots fly the scene. They're equipped with the computers that can handle the extra load of all the UAS data processing. And when you look at the different skill sets that are needed, they can analyze all that remotely sensed data collected by the UAS. And we typically have three products, whether it's an orthomosaic, a point cloud, or digital surface models. But what this allows them to do is they're the subject matter experts, and they can create these products for us, where now we have a 3D image that can be rotated. We can take simple measurements if we have to, such as height or distance for that matter, or because of that integration with our GIS individuals, and we have real-time kinematic GPS, and using ground control points, we can do crime scenes that are accurate to half of an inch. And it just is a game changer in the capabilities. And it's important to understand the UAS is more than just something to capture video. There's a lot more capabilities to it. You just have to bring the right people in. And sometimes those people are outside our normal circles of law enforcement. The reason we have it is because emergency management is part of our agency. But most municipalities, counties have a GIS person. It just might not always be in their police department. It may be part of the municipality. And that's been very beneficial to us. And also, if we do have to go to court, as Sergeant Rogers said about, you know, it being defendable, the GIS personnel, they're the experts. They understand GPS, and they understand how these systems work, and can explain what an orthomosaic is and point cloud much better than at least myself or Sergeant Rogers.
One of the things that you said earlier is that you have 7 districts within the state, and that you ideally want a UAS in each district. My question for you, Sergeant Rogers, is how do you deploy them? What's the typical process for getting one in the air when a need is identified?
Great question. So any law enforcement agency in Michigan could call for our services, to include any fire department for that matter, when it comes to the UAS or our aviation unit. So the call would initially come in to either myself or the chief pilot, and we would vet that call. We would determine what the request for service is, and then also what the best aviation asset is for that specific call. You know, a lot of times it is the UAS, but there are some times when someone will call for either the helicopter, and we'll say actually the UAS is a better tool for that job, or vice versa. We're there to deploy the best resource to provide the best service we can to that requesting agency. If the UAS is chosen as the tool to deploy to that, my initial reaction, my initial thing that I do is certainly check the current weather in the area where we're going to be going, and then also forecasted weather to make sure that there's nothing inclement that's going to come into the scene. Certainly in Michigan, we deal with all four seasons in the middle of the summer. We can deal with all four seasons. So weather is certainly very important for us to check in Michigan right out of the gate. After that is done and we feel that we have the weather minimums that are set by the FAA, we'll file a notice to airmen. And what that is it's a contact to a aviation briefer. And we tell them where we're going to be operating, what time we're going to be operating, and what altitude we're going to be operating at. And what happens then is it will show up on an aviation map. It'll show actually where we're going to be operating. It'll be a purple circle on a sectional chart for for the manned aircraft aviators out there. It'll show up where we're going to be operating and when. And all that is it just provides another layer of safety. It lets manned aircraft know where we're going to be and when we're going to be there. So that's those are the very first two steps. And then it's drive time. So, you know, the call could be 10 minutes away. It could be 7-8 hours away, depending on where we're going. You know, I live in Grand Rapids. I could be going to the Upper Peninsula, and it could take me 6 or 7 hours to get there. So it's just kind of the nature of the beast that we deal with being in Michigan. You know, most calls are within an hour or two drive time at most. So at that point, it's drive time to the scene. Also, while I'm driving, I'm contacting an observer. Our COA requires us to have at least one observer on scene, a trained observer. They have to have a medical that's done every 2 years to show their competency and their vision and things like that. That's per the FAA regulations. So we'll contact those observers. We have observers trained throughout the state. We've actually trained up our fire investigators because they call us a lot. So we've trained them to be observers. They're already on the scene. They're calling for our services. We can just utilize them at the scene. We've trained our accident reconstructionists and then also our bomb squad personnel because they, too, are scattered around the state. So it just makes that response time that much easier. And getting that observer on scene is, in my opinion, is critical to the operation of an unmanned aircraft. I mean, we've had incidents where we've had unmanned aircraft come into our scenes that we're trying to document, and the observers pick them up right away, where the operator of the aircraft may be buried into the video feed or something like that, making sure that the imagery is being taken properly. So having that observer on scene is critical to the safe operation, in my opinion. You know, we get on scene, we determine what the requester is looking for. Are they looking for video? Are they looking for, as Colonel Kolinsky said, an orthomosaic? So that's a straight down image of the entire scene that we can scale to within half inch accuracy. So we determine, you know, what the request is, what the finished product they're looking for. And then, you know, we will fly the scene at that point. You know, you're locating a safe landing zone, takeoff zone, that's away from people and things like that. If video streaming is necessary for the scene, maybe it's a dynamic scene, maybe it's assisting our emergency support team on a barricaded suspect or something like that, we've got monitors that we can deploy and allow those people involved with the call to be able to observe that video from a location away from us, so which is obviously quite important. And then it's just a matter of flying the scene, whatever the mission set is at the time.
We are speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Chris Kolinsky and Sergeant Matt Rogers from the Michigan State Police. One of the things that I hear when I listen to you, Sergeant Rogers, is your understanding of the aviation issues related to operating a drone and your background of having a pilot's license from what I presume is your prior work in the air program of MSP. Does one need to have experienced pilots to implement an unmanned aircraft program, or at least seriously consider it?
That's a great question. You know, that it certainly never hurts. The more knowledge you can have, I mean, aviation, anybody who's a manned aircraft pilot understands the complexity of manned aircraft. It's, you know, from somebody who has no experience with it, and you start to dive into the FAA rules and regulations, you can get overwhelmed extremely quickly. So, and that's, I think that's part of some agencies maybe being a little apprehensive on deploying this technology because they dove into the FAA rules and regulations one time and were overwhelmed in a matter of minutes and walked away from it and said, it's not for me. Mm-hmm. So since 2016, the FAA has certainly created a new avenue for law enforcement agencies who have no aviation background to actually be competent operators in unmanned aircraft, and that's the Part 107 ruling that came out. So an unmanned aircraft operator now simply needs to take a test that's provided by the FAA. So the FAA has set these are the standards and procedures that we need our unmanned aircraft operators to be able to competently achieve. And they determine that through the testing that they do. So if you become an unmanned aircraft operator, I think you've scratched the surface on being a competent UAS operator in law enforcement. So you're at the first step, certainly.
As we begin to wrap up, what are the things that I have not asked you that you think is important in implementing and operating an unmanned aircraft system? Sergeant Rogers?
So one of the things when we started our program is there's a ton of marketing when it comes to the UAS out there in law enforcement. And this is 2014, 2015. If you listen to the UAS marketers out there, they were telling law enforcement that you can clear a crash scene in 10 minutes and have that freeway open back up within a matter of minutes just by taking a series of photographs from our drone. You can open up that roadway. And to a degree, we kind of bought into that a little bit because it's got GPS on it. You buy the software program called PIX4D and you seam the photos together and voila, you've got a great image of the scene. Well, you do have a fantastic image of the scene. The problem is you can't take one measurement from it with any sort of accuracy. So, and we learned that very early on. I remember there was a scene that we did with one of our reconstructionists, and he said, I trust the UAS. I said, I wouldn't do that. I would take my ground measurements if I was you. So he ended up doing that. Fortunately, he did, because we got the scene processed. We went through the whole process, and we were off by like 15 feet over a 200-foot span. That is not something that's defensible in court, as we go back to the previous comment I made. Be careful with the marketing piece out there. There's a lot of agencies that have already paved the way here, and all you have to do is reach out to those agencies. I have not met one agency that wasn't willing to share their pitfalls and their successes with their UAS program. So I would encourage law enforcement to reach out to their partners to get clarification on some of those things.
Colonel Kalinske, anything to add?
And if I could just reiterate that last point, because you have a balance of those trying to sell the equipment and then the officers that are out there. And as Sergeant Rogers said, I mean, a lot of the work has already been done. I mean, there's a lot of agencies that are out there that painstakingly have gone through this process, crashed these UASs and gotten the measurements and found out what those, you know, what the errors were and why things were happening. So especially with measurements, we've learned a tremendous amount from where we started from. And knowing now that we have these RTK GPS antennas throughout our state, last I checked, there's 33 states that have these permanent stations throughout their state that they can, you know, utilize. It's usually run by their Department of Transportation. There's a lot of law enforcement agencies that aren't even aware of that. But if you were to ask somebody that does GIS work, they're very aware of it. So reach out to those agencies and don't be afraid to ask them any questions, because while you may think you want a UAS program, once you start asking questions, you know, you might say, yeah, this is a great tool, but we're just not in a position to do it. But that's where maybe your state agency or county agencies can assist.
That's a great segue to my final question. If someone wanted to get more information from you about unmanned aircraft systems and the Michigan State Police's program, how should they contact you, Sergeant Roger?
They can simply send send me an email. I mean, that's easy enough. It's rogersm11@michigan.gov, rogersm11@michigan.gov, spelled out.
We've been listening to Lieutenant Colonel Chris Kalinske and Sergeant Matt Rogers discussing the Unmanned Aircraft System, or UAS, program of the Michigan State Police. Thank you for joining us on The Beat.
The Beat is brought to you by the United States Department of Justice's COPS Office. The COPS Office helps to keep our nation's communities safe by giving grants to law enforcement agencies, developing community policing publications, developing partnerships, and solving problems. If you have comments or suggestions, please email our response center at askcopsrc@usdoj.gov or check out our social media on Facebook, www.facebook.com/DOJ Cops, on YouTube, www.youtube.com/C/DOJ Cops Office, or on Twitter @Cops Office. Our website is www.cops.usdoj.gov. The opinions contained herein are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. References to specific agencies, companies, products, or services should not be considered an endorsement by the authors or the U.S. Department of Justice. Rather, the references are illustrations to supplement discussion of the issues.